You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Did you know that if every single homeless person in the city of Los Angeles said all at the same time, I want to go to a shelter today, the city wouldn't have enough beds? Not even close. At the same time, a court ruling says the city cannot ticket or arrest anyone for camping on public property unless there's shelter available. That's one reason you see large encampments all over town. And that's one reason the city passed new laws over the summer to prohibit camping and offer whatever shelter is available in a targeted way, specifically in locations deemed sensitive or dangerous, like close to elementary schools or driveways. But months later, a lot of folks are frustrated. The housed, the unhoused, and their advocates, even a city council member, say that too often the new policy simply shuffles homeless people from one spot to another, and outreach isn't happening like it's supposed to.
They actually just stop and be like, hey, you guys want some water? You guys want some lunches? And then that's it. Nothing about the resources, you know.
That's an unhoused man who would only give his name as Summer of 89. He spoke last week during a homeless camp cleanup in Silver Lake on a street that's off limits under the new law. As sanitation trucks moved up the block, Summer said he'd been contacted by outreach workers only once.
And they said, hey, you know, we're just going to get down your information if you don't mind. And you know, we're going to put you on the list for resources to get housing because, I mean, getting off the street would be better. And I said, you know what? Yeah, of course. You know, getting off the street would be great, you know. And they said, okay, your name. I gave him my name, my birth date, my information, and this was several months ago, and still haven't had word on that back.
Why not? And what happened to offering people shelter when you ask them to leave the sidewalk? KCRW's housing and homelessness reporter Anna Scott has the story.
Here's how the city's new laws work. On paper, council members can pick specific spots in their districts where they want to outlaw street camping. They get the locations approved by their colleagues. Then they can put up signs saying, hey, this place is off limits for camping. So far, they've approved 201 locations around the city of Los Angeles and posted signs at 45 of them. But here's the key part. Before posting the signs, city council offices are supposed to work with the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority to do outreach to anyone camped at these spots, match them up with whatever services and housing opportunities are available, and try to move them indoors.
It was meant to be accompanied by a street engagement strategy. That didn't happen.
Stephanie Klosky-Gamer is president and CEO of the nonprofit LA Family Housing.
It was about how do we humanely engage with people and provide opportunities for them to move to appropriate places based on their needs.
But Klosky-Gamer and others say the city council is putting up signs faster than they can find beds. And the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority confirms that the county's shelter system is basically full right now, though they don't actually know exactly how many beds are available.
It is frustrating.
Richard Carrizales used to stay on the same street in Silver Lake where Summer of 89, who you heard earlier, also camped. Carrizales says during cleanups, he relocates to elsewhere in the neighborhood. He has been approached by outreach workers in the past, but says it didn't go anywhere.
They come in and tell you the same thing over, and they still don't do nothing about it. They'll try to send somebody else later on in the day and to talk to you, to fill out a piece of paper, to put your name on. It's just another waiting list.
A spokesman for the council member who represents the Silver Lake area, Mitch O'Farrell, said his office is not ticketing people under the new laws or even preventing them from returning to areas marked as no camping zones yet, partly because of the scarcity of resources. Instead, he said, they're doing cleanups to control the size of encampments and keep the sidewalks passable. But a different city council member thinks that the city is making the lack of beds and services even worse by the way that they're carrying out this new policy.
Los Angeles has essentially built a system where each of the 15 council districts kind of handle the issue for themselves. And the ways in which this plays out is absurd and incredibly sad.
Nithya Raman represents District 4, which includes Larchmont, the Hollywood Hills, and Sherman Oaks. She says one problem with the new policy is that council members generally reserve shelter beds and housing units for people who are homeless in their districts, which sounds logical, but Raman and others argue that it actually makes it harder to get people off the streets. Like, here's an example from Klosky Gamer, head of LA Family Housing.
We had somebody experiencing homelessness set up a tent in the pouring rain a few weeks ago right outside my office. Unfortunately, my office and the corner where these folks set up their tent was in one council district. And while we had vacant beds in three interim housing sites nearby, they were in three different council districts. And they stayed outside for 2 weeks in the rain.
I understand the concerns about it, the possibilities of restricting access in some cases, but there's a counterweight to that.
City Council member Bob Blumenfield represents LA's 3rd District, which encompasses Canoga Park, Tarzana, and Woodland Hills. Blumenfield defends the district-by-district approach. He says it forces politicians and their constituents to create shelters, housing, and services in every part of Los Angeles, instead of trying to push the problem somewhere else.
That's what we did for decades, and it didn't work. For decades, you know, when there were homeless people, what happened to them? They got sent down to Skid Row because that's where the openings were.
Even now, with thousands more beds all over Los Angeles than there were just a few years ago, both the housed and the unhoused are frustrated by a lack of progress on the streets.
I'm so used to seeing this living here, and there's nothing they can do about it.
80-year-old Angel Cipriano lives in a house at the end of a cul-de-sac in East Hollywood, another new no-camping zone. As a cleanup got underway there last week, Cipriano predicted that unhoused people would move for a few hours and then return.
I want you to stick around after they're finished, and they'll be back within a half hour.
Only one unhoused man was on the street at the time, wrapped up in a sleeping bag. He didn't want his name or his voice on tape, but we spoke at length. I'll call him R. R said that after signs went up about no camping, a few people who had been camped on the block moved their tents over a fence, from the sidewalk to a strip of dirt beside the freeway outside LA city limits. R said he receives health care in Venice, but nobody had offered him shelter or services in recent weeks. Cipriano, who lives in the house across the street, said he doesn't blame R for the situation.
He's my neighbor. When it gets cold, that hat he has on was mine. When it gets cold and it's raining, he's got my golf jacket. Thanksgiving, he got nobody to give him, come down here and give him a turkey leg. Yeah, what are you gonna do? Do I think he likes living like that? Girl, I get up, I put a K-pot in a machine, hot cup of coffee, I brush my teeth, I have a restroom, take a shower. I can't not feel what he's going through. It's a toughie.
After a couple of days, I got a text from Cipriano's unhoused neighbor, R. It said, 48 hours later, still no outreach. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. California hasn't executed anyone on death row since 2006. First, it was a court order that put a freeze on executions. Then a few years ago, in 2019, Governor Gavin Newsom placed a moratorium on them. Well, now the governor says he wants to dismantle death row altogether in the next 2 years, where still nearly 700 people are locked up. the largest death row of any state in the nation.
Premeditated murder is wrong in all its forms and manifestation, including government-sponsored premeditated murder. I don't support the death penalty, never have. I think there's other ways to hold people to account.
In his statement, the governor also said that life in prison with no parole is, quote, foundationally one of them. So what's it like living on death row? Are people there treated differently behind bars than anyone else? Well, today, we're going to get that perspective of someone who not only got off the state's death row, but is now on the outside. In fact, he works at the place where he was once serving his sentence, San Quentin. Watson Allison, who goes by Al, grew up here in Southern California, was a member of the Long Beach Crips years ago. Now, decades later, has turned his life around as a certified alcohol and drug counselor. And he joins me right now. Al, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
I want to start with the news that Governor Newsom will dismantle death row. I mean, a lot of folks may not know, but death row is sometimes referred to as a prison within a prison. Explain that for us.
Well, actually, it is. You're in the prison, but you're in an isolated unit. It's pretty much just self-contained, right? You spend a lot of time in your cell, and pretty much everything inside of that building, it comes to you. It's pretty much like solitary confinement, except you get a few hours a week pretty much to interact. But most of your time, you're isolated by yourself.
What was it like for you, Al? And I'm trying to get an understanding of what it's like for you in death row. Did you know how it was going to end up for you?
No, not at all. Not at all.
You didn't know if you were going to die behind bars there or if you were going to be put to death by the state of California.
I actually thought one or the other. I didn't ever expect the outcome to happen that happened. This is shocking. I still just sit back and reflect on it a lot. I actually thought that I would either be executed or, you know, just die of natural causes right there. I knew a few guys there who had committed suicide, a few guys who had died of natural causes. It was one of those surreal moments. I'd accepted the fact that one way or another, I was going to die in prison.
You've described death row as very, very lonely and isolating. You were on death row for almost 30 years. Do you think it changed you? I mean, do you think that living like that, you know, that loneliness and the things that you could, you know, the limited things that you could do to help yourself changed you in any way?
Yes, it changed me. It changed me a lot. I had a lot of time to self-evaluate, reevaluate, and look at my dysfunctional nature when I was in the world before coming to death row and just feeling like, man, you know, being caught up in a lot of negativity and thinking I was a normal way of life. And so now, you know, you sit back and reflect on all of that and realize how dysfunctional it actually was. I had a lot of support, you know, people trying to help me stay in a healthy, balanced state of mind.
In 2010, your life changed. You had been convicted, right, of murder. You were on death row. And then in 2010, a federal judge reversed the original jury's findings and then set aside the death sentence in your case. And then the DA, the district attorney, decided not to retry you, and you were resentenced to 25 years to life. Tell us how you found out about that news and what your feeling was when it happened. I can't imagine.
It was late in the evening. I was sitting in my cell eating a tuna sandwich and some sour cream and onion potato chips and drinking some Kool-Aid. And one of the guards came to my door and said, hey, they're going to be taking you downstairs to talk to the lieutenant in a minute. And I'm thinking it's for some disciplinary reason, a rules violation or something where I was going to get that hurt or something. I didn't have no idea about this. And the lieutenant was standing in the door of his office, and the two guards that took me down there were standing outside the door. And to my surprise, the first thing he did was patted me on the back and said, congratulations. Now, that had never happened before. And I went in and sat down, and he had a phone where he pushed the button on the phone, and my lawyer's voice came over the phone and said, "Al, congratulations, your case was overturned." And I went numb. We walked back to my cell, and a couple of guys that knew me asked me what was going on, and I could barely speak. So once I got back in the cell, I just sat on the edge of my bed. I couldn't eat. I really couldn't even think about nothing.
When did you finally get released?
Just 2020. After I went to a parole board hearing while I was in reception, and the commissioner, he let me know, "Hey, we're not going to let the same guy out who came in. And you must work on yourself and rehabilitate and, take on a more positive way of life. And it must be for real. It must be serious." So I got to general population. I signed up for school, got in school, and I started taking every self-help program it was. And I explained my situation to one of the counselors at Solano State Prison. And she was very instrumental in me being rehabilitated. She was in charge of assigning people to take, like, substance abuse, anger management, criminal thinking, denial management, relapse prevention, that type of stuff. And I needed all of that. So I would go to those classes in the evening time and go to school in the daytime.
As I mentioned earlier, you work now as a certified alcohol and drug counselor. You are a success story for rehabilitation, and some of the groups that you counsel are at San Quentin. How does it feel to walk back into that place that you were locked up in? You know, you're a free man. How does that feel?
The first day was like I had, irritable stomach, a lot of nerve jitters and a whole lot of stuff. And I seen a few guys who I knew for like years that were still inmates there. And they were shocked. A lot of the guards were shocked. And it was like, man, we weren't ever going to take any groups, but now seeing you come back in here, we signing up. We don't want to just die here from old age or whatever. We want to get out also. So it motivated a lot of people.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and talking to us today, Watson Allison. Al, as you're known, certified alcohol and drug counselor over at San Quentin and at other places as well. Al, thank you for taking time out to talk to us and better explain what it's really like over there.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Al's story is rare, and to put his story in context, I'm joined now by Ellen Kreitzberg. She's a professor at the Santa Clara University of Law, where she's the director of the Death Penalty College. Professor, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with a basic question. How do people who are convicted get sentenced to death in the first place?
So actually, it has to start in the district attorney's office, because the district attorney in each county will make the decision whether or not to seek the death penalty in any particular case. And it's really almost unreviewable. So as people in Los Angeles know, for a long time under Jackie Lacey, she was deciding to seek the death penalty in a huge number of cases over the years. And their new district attorney has decided not to follow that pattern.
Is that the reason, do you think, that there's this? I mean, it's pretty proportional, but about 30% of people serving on death row are from L.A. County, right?
So there is a large percentage or a large number of people from Los Angeles on death row currently. It's obviously an area with a large population, but it also was a city where the district attorney made the determination to seek it in a large number of times.
So I'm assuming here, Professor, that the person then begins. So when the death sentence is passed down, right, that the person starts serving a death sentence immediately. Do they go directly to death row?
Once the trial is over, they've been convicted, and then the penalty trial is over, and they've been sentenced to death, then they would go to death row. And it's while they're on death row that all of these appeals take place, and it's why many people have been on death row for 10, 20, or more years. Most of them are still going through the appellate process, and their case is still winding its way through the courts.
Just because Governor Newsom is dismantling death row, he, he doesn't have the power to get rid of the death penalty, right?
No, everyone should understand the difference between abolition, to abolish the death penalty, and to no longer have it available as an option, and what Governor Newsom has done, which is a moratorium, which is more what we might call a pause. He says, I am not going to sign a warrant, so no one will be executed while I'm governor. And in California, abolition is very complicated because of our initiative process. The death penalty was brought to California by initiative, so it can only be abolished by initiative. It cannot be by the governor himself.
Governor Newsom's executive order about death row is actually part of a voter-approved initiative from 2016. There were two measures back in 2016 where people in California voted on differing death penalty issues. I'm talking about Prop 62 and then Prop 66. Talk about both of those for me, if you will, starting with Prop 62. What did that do?
Yeah, so in 2016, there were two initiatives put to the people of California, and Proposition 62 set out a measure which would abolish the death penalty. Only 47% of the voters voted to abolish the death penalty in 2016, although in Los Angeles, I believe it was a majority of the voters voted to abolish it. The same year, there was a second proposition known as Prop 66 that had a number of measures that were thrown in together, including to try and expedite executions to get cases to move more quickly, but also had a provision that required or encouraged more work by people in institutions and payment of restitutions to victims. So what Governor Newsom is doing in this measure of dismantling death row, moving those individuals into other institutions and requiring them to work is really responding directly to Proposition 66 that said victims should be given restitution, and that's going to be part of the outcome of this movement out of San Quentin.
There is so much emotion around this issue. And there are so many victims who say, you know, that this is the only way. Some crimes are just so heinous that this is the only way for justice. And what do people say in accordance with those kinds of emotions?
The concerns of victims and victims' families should be a very important issue, and it's something the governor is not oblivious to. In fact, it's very concerned about. But when we define justice, we have to think of it from a number of perspectives. First, that in deciding which cases should be sought death, we don't do it in all first-degree murder cases. We decide we will do it in one case, but not in the next 20 cases. So it has been arbitrary in that sense that only certain victims' families have the death penalty in their cases. And we've seen over the years that those decisions, intentionally or unintentionally, have often been racially biased. Where the victim is white, the death penalty is sought more often. The other thing is the death penalty has brought victims and victims' families a lot of uncertainty and false expectations. People have been waiting for decades for what they call justice, where if there was no death penalty, the cases would be over, finished, done and out of the courts, and the individuals would be serving their sentences without any press coverage, without any newsworthiness, and those cases would be complete. In many ways, that's far more justice.
Why do you think in a state as progressive and pretty solidly blue as California that voters by a slim margin vote to keep the death penalty, right? It's come down over the years, but it's still a majority of the people polled.
The death penalty has always been a political football. It's been something which is used by politicians to show they're tough on crime. It's been used to show they care about victims, although we know it often the opposite is true. And it's also used to distort information to voters. We find that the more informed the voters are, the more likely they are to vote against the death penalty. So, for example, most voters in California did not realize that it is more expensive to implement the death penalty in California than it is to implement the sentence of life without the possibility of parole. Most people don't know about the racial inequities of it. Most people think that it's reserved for the worst of the worst. But what we're seeing in these cases is the individuals who are getting the death penalty are really more like the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. They're people with severe mental illnesses. Many have been subject to childhood trauma. Now, none of that means they shouldn't be held accountable for their crimes, for their murders. But the question is, do we want to be executing them?
Well, thank you, Professor, for coming on and explaining it to us. Ellen Kreitzberg, professor at the Santa Clara University of Law and the director of the Death Penalty College. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for us today. I hope you'll check us out tomorrow when we report on the immense strain that COVID has had on public transportation. Bus drivers have gotten sick. And that leads to absences, even route shortages, and it affects the people who don't have very many transit options in the first place. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Share your thoughts with us. Give us some story ideas. And you can get the podcast, too, wherever you get your podcasts or at kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece this evening's episode together. I'm Steve Chutakis. Thanks for your time and attention. Have a great night.